was so much more to come. There was a drawing out of the violent act, a close-up on the details of violence that made the violence itself fascinating. Its universe of punishments populated with infinite gradations, infinite shades of red and pink that I had never before been taught to notice. During the first few frames of sudden violence, I had read no subtlety into it, the blood no more nuanced than the garish red droplets sometimes accompanying the Catholic Stations of the Cross, or the ones splattered all over the painting of the blood-red, gnarled Jesus hand my father had had commissioned for his jail ministry and pasted to the back of his truck. The words, "Christ died for sin, sins, sinners," bolded in red. Bullshit. Then slowly, the blood became something else. Art. I wanted to find other names for it. I wanted to watch the movie again just to see how the Jackson Pollock blood fell. Charles and Dominique had already stopped their bickering and were now watching, incredulous, as each one of Jesus' features was systematically reduced to bloody shreds. The message of this film was clear. Violence had replaced all other considerations. It no longer seemed to matter whether the man on screen was black or white. Here was a horror that seemed to belong to people of all races and creeds. "I can't watch this," Charles said, shielding his eyes with his palms. "This is too much."
"It's almost over," Dominique said, tossing back another handful of popcorn. "The good part's coming up."
"Father, forgive them," Jesus said, his voice muffled by blood, his teeth chattering, his eyes fixed on a future no one else around him could possibly see. "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." A tear-tracked Mary dug her hands into the ground and gripped two fistfuls of dirt, her features distorted by grief, by disbelief. Critics were saying the movie was supposed to be more accurate than the Bible, that Gibson had spent a great deal of time and money making the crucifixion seem real. But as I watched Jesus' flayed torso struggle with gravity, I couldn't believe that the human body was capable of sustaining such violence. There had to be some limit, some point at which the Roman authorities checked for a pulse. Or perhaps we all had different limits. Charles and Dominique had sometimes spoken of their ancestors, born into slavery, who would receive extensive whippings for no reason at all, and yet many of these same ancestors had lived long lives of servitude, their wounds healing over, their skin becoming tougher, the nightmare proceeding on as planned. Compared to the on-screen pain, my pain felt pointless, a thing of no significance. I hadn't been whipped or beaten. I hadn't suffered for my goodness. It was certainly true that since the moment David had outed me, some part of me had still been lying in the back seat of my mother's car, watching the milky ribbon of stars and waiting for the blows to come. But even as I knew more of them would surely come, I also knew they would never add up to what I was seeing in the theater. I didn't have the right to complain. I would go through with the therapy. I would complete my application. This wasn't the first time I'd made a decision based solely on guilt. My first fantasies of martyrdom arrived the day I turned 16. Chloe had gifted me her copy of Jesus Freaks, Martyrs, for my birthday, suggesting that it would draw us closer together if I read it.
"It changed my life," she'd said. "I'm not afraid to follow Christ now, no matter what happens. I don't care if someone holds a gun to my head."
I had felt special reading those stories, a series of gruesome deaths at the hands of unbelievers serving as examples of the kind of extreme devotion required in these end times. I would read the book for hours in my bedroom, the door locked, and imagine armed SWAT teams bursting through every lock and hinge to interrogate me. I would imagine how proud Chloe and my parents would be if they heard me speaking into the barrel of a machine gun, biting down hard on the muzzle, mumbling, "I will not renounce Jesus Christ as my personal savior." But in truth, I worried about what I would really say when the apocalypse finally arrived. I worried mostly because I felt I was evil somewhere deep inside, in the same place I had stored my fantasies of older men. Some of them men from the dealership, some from the church, though their features hardly mattered. Pressed tightly beneath my fear and shame, their faces and bodies swirled into one ominous mass that threatened to rear up and expose me. Focusing on the violence, even taking pleasure in the fantasy of it, actually did manage to draw Chloe and me closer together. It made it easier for me to ignore my temptations, focus on doing the right thing, imagine a future as a husband to a kind and beautiful Christian wife. And for a few years, we were united in our love of Christ, in our love of martyrdom.
I felt this strong undertow once again while watching The Passion. I had come to this theater to mock what I should have known could never properly be mocked by someone with my background. I wanted to run away, hide my face in the cleft of the rock, as Moses famously did in God's presence. As the canned theater lights brightened, I turned away from the white-haired deacons kneeling at the front of the theater, but only after a tentative look back. The air outside was cold, and a low, lonely wind accompanied us to the Explorer my father had bought for me just before college. Only a few scattered cars dotted the parking lot, some of them no doubt belonging to the kneeling moviegoers. It was strange to see them there, to see my car alone at the other end of the lot, to see all of the buildings and factories that had brought us to this point in history, 2 millennia removed from the world we'd seen on screen. A canopy of fog had lowered in the distance and seemed to be spreading over the length of our small city. It was going to cover everything, put a blanket between us and the stars. What's the point of all this, I thought, once everything goes? Where are you going? Charles said. Charles and Dominique were already standing in front of the Explorer, waiting for me to unlock its doors. I had walked past them without realizing, headed someplace I didn't know. A few minutes later, we were sitting in McDonald's, the only well-lit building for miles around. I wasn't certain how we'd gotten there, oblivious as my mind had been since we'd left the theater. It was a wonder I hadn't wrecked us. Driving under these conditions was just another stupid thing about that evening.
"You look like you've seen a ghost," Dominique said,
dipping a greasy fry into a paper cup she'd filled to the brim with ketchup. The clock above her head was drawing close to midnight, but I had no place to go. Tomorrow was Saturday, and we all seemed a little restless. "I can't get over it," I said, unwrapping my Big Mac. These burgers never looked how you wanted them to look. I tried pushing the second patty back beneath the bun, but the sandwich began to fall apart, so I took a bite as quickly as I could.
"It's just a movie," Dominique said. "None of it was real."
Charles snorted into his Coke. "I've seen worse." "Maybe it was worse than what we saw," I said, feeling the burger glide slowly to my stomach. The bite was too much, I realized. "Maybe we'd lose our minds if we saw how the crucifixion really looked."
"Maybe," Charles said, standing up. "Maybe we'd lose our minds if we saw a lot of things."
Dominique slapped the table. "Try watching someone get shot in your own neighborhood." "Have you seen that?" I said. The burger was stuck in the middle of my esophagus. I was going to be sick.
"No," Dominique said, "but I'm sure I will if I move back home. It's bound to happen."
"It happens to everyone in our neighborhood," Charles said, heading to the counter to fill several more paper cups with ketchup.
There were never enough paper cups. It seemed as though someone had designed the cups so you'd have to get up for more ketchup every few minutes. They made the condiments seem precious, lined up in a row across our table, a string of rubies glistening beneath the fluorescence.
"All of this is so fake," I suddenly thought.
I imagined walking into Charles and Dominique's neighborhood, watching a pedestrian get shot, blood sweeping across the face of a white t-shirt. Would everything seem less fake if I saw through to the heart of this violence?
"Doesn't it feel wrong?" I said, tossing the sandwich back on the table, the marbled sauce dripping on all sides.
"Eating after what we saw?"
"It seems natural to me," Charles said, returning with the cups. "We have to eat."
"Listen," Dominique said, dipping another fry in the ketchup. "We only came because you wanted us to, and now you're acting like we did something wrong. So the movie was a little more intense than we thought it'd be. So what? We're here, we're alive, and we've got good grades. God would want us to be thankful for that."
"God wants us to make good grades?" Charles said. "Oh, Lord."
"And God would want you to eat that Big Mac," Dominique added. "Speaking of which, are you going to eat that? Because if not..."
I pushed my Big Mac over to Dominique.
"You don't get it," I said.
This wasn't their fault, of course. I told them almost nothing of what I was going through with my family, and it must have seemed unfair to them that only a minute before I had been so nonchalant about my Christianity, whereas now I must have looked like a zealot, like my father. I knew I would never be able to tell them what was going on, that no matter how many days we spent together, I would continue walking through life with one foot in a world they'd never seen, just as they had lived with one foot in a neighborhood I'd never visited.
You know what you need? Dominique said, tapping her foot on the tile. You need a song.
I could feel the burger churning in my stomach now. It took all of my energy to keep from making a face.
Please no, Charles said, rolling his eyes. It's all we do.
A spot of ketchup clung to his bottom lip, garishly red. I thought of the article I'd read, the one about the new blood they'd developed for the passion, a sickeningly sweet one. Red dye, fatty gums, all suspended in glycerin, in order to make it appear more viscous.
Dominique stood up, wiped her salt-covered hands on her navy blue blouse, and cleared her throat. She looked around for a few seconds. There were only about 3 or 4 people in the restaurant. Outside the windows, a hazy orange fog roiled over everything, obscuring the road. A few snowflakes clung to the window, melted, and traced lines down the glass. For a moment it seemed we were part of some extravagant snow globe, that someone had shaken us up and turned the key for the music box.
Dominique grabbed Charles under his arms and forced him to his feet, nearly toppling over the line of ketchup cups.
Summertime, she sang, incredibly in tune, incredibly out of season.
Some of the people turned their heads.
What are you doing with them?
Charles joined her. I kept quiet.
There's a nothing can harm you, they sang in harmony, with your daddy and mammy standing by.
I rushed to the bathroom and closed the door on their singing. I stared into the placid water and waited, but nothing came. It was just the reflection of a skinny face I could barely recognize. In my secret life, ex-gay therapy grows inside me, takes up residence under my excess skin, grips the lining of my stomach. My stomach churns with the tide of coffee and the Egg McMuffin my mother forced me to eat on the way to the session, the yellow wrapper crinkling and the car's tires thumping over the Mississippi-Arkansas bridge. My mother has been doing this a lot lately, forcing me to eat calorie-rich food, sneaking real mayonnaise into my sandwiches when I'm not looking, and it's as though the work I've been doing to make myself invisible is all for nothing.
Your thoughts are harmful to God, the ex-gay counselor says,
his eyes fixed on the glass-topped desk between us. From this angle, his eyebrows look like 2 large black commas. He is here to interrupt me.
They're disgusting, unnatural, an abomination.
I keep thinking about how he'd said the word masturbation. The word sits somewhere in the room, refusing to leave. I know, I say. I'm trying.
Your mother and I think you should attend the source, he says, holding out a sheet of paper. It's a 2-week program. Very brief, but effective.
The source. The stories I write almost daily now also have the ability to hide the source of my pain, to obscure me from my sinful nature. When I'm not sitting in front of this counselor, when I'm instead sitting with Charles and Dominique in my dorm room and scribbling in my moleskin, I forget about my affliction, feeling only the joy and frustration of the written word, how it refuses to wrap around what my mind is seeing. The writing is both bigger and so much smaller than what I'd imagined. But I can't run from my pain, as this counselor has told me many times. I can't run from my disgusting nature, no matter how skinny I get. Eventually, I must return to the source. The campus was quiet that night, with only the muffled thumping of fraternity subwoofers giving life to the evening air. A peaceful vibration that made it seem as though the unlit corners of the academic buildings might hold some promise of excitement, some other world just outside this one. The top floor of the humanities building shone in the distance, and on the terrace just outside the faculty lounge stood a lonely figure, a late-night studier on a Friday night, a skinny student who seemed to live inside the building at all hours. He never failed to arouse some feelings of guilt in me. Some fear that I hadn't read the assigned section of the Fairy Queen as well as I might have. He could have been me, really. A far more focused me, someone with both feet planted solidly in one place, eyes trained on a future full of books and wood-paneled rooms and late-night coffee sessions. Years later, I would be jealous of people like him, people whose brains never seemed to turn against them, even though I really had no idea what he thought on all those lonely nights. I slipped past a few more buildings. Dead grass crunching under my shoes. The air cold, since I sported only a light black sweater. Why are you going out like that? Charles had said. And I hadn't provided him a real answer, just that I was restless and wanted to feel the cold air on my skin.
I reached a small garden, kicked up gravel in my path, and made my way to a cold stone bench. A tall hedge kept me hidden from the quad, but just above its bare branches I could make out the campus chapel's steeple lit up on all sides by three generous floodlights. One night during the beginning of the school year, I had climbed to this steeple with a group of friends, Charles and Dominique among them, David among them. We'd leaped over the struts of the chapel ceiling, big brass organ pipes gleaming in the refracted moonlight below, and made our way up a rusty ladder, trying to stifle our laughter the whole way. Just before we reached the very top, as we stood before a dark stairwell that would open onto a narrow terrace bounding the steeple, a senior pressed a finger to his lips and told us that we needed to know the truth about this place. He told us that the college used to be a Masonic home for orphans that had burned to the ground in the early 1900s, killing several children. Three of those burned children were rumored to stand each night at the base of the steeple and hold hands. Three children with no names, their features erased by flames. The story added a bit more adrenaline to what we already felt while climbing all those rungs in the dark, brushing past thick cobwebs and holding hands with people we barely knew but were already calling friends, already trusting those friends to hoist us across the gaps. The thought of all that scarred flesh, all those lonely children trapped inside with no one to mourn them, mixed with a kind of superstition that only complete darkness could still inspire in a student body as skeptical as ours. When we finally reached the top and the warm late summer air met our skin, we were shocked to find only scuffed concrete and dust. And all of us held hands around the steeple in memory of those children, feeling, as we all must have felt, as I remember feeling with David's warm palm gripped in mine, that the bonds we formed that night would hold forever. Outside the garden, fog was falling over the academic buildings, over the humanities boy who never stopped studying. And the bench I was sitting on began to feel like a tiny island adrift in a sea of white. The Garden of Gethsemane, I thought, remembering the Passion. The night before his crucifixion, Jesus had tried to comfort the disciples, to let them know that all of the pain they would soon endure would be worth it, that the violence would fulfill his promises. I wondered if it had been the same for the orphans. Had there been someone around to comfort them before the fire began to lick their arms? I hugged myself, wrapped my arms as tightly as I could around my chest, the feeling of my skinny ribs good to me, the cold good to me. All of it was good, I realized, if you only trusted that everything would make sense in the end. The snow had yet to arrive, only the hint of it, but it would come eventually, even if it was late in the season. It would cover everything, build its strange gardens over secreted objects, sculpt the world into something new. In my secret life, therapy engulfs me, swells over me until I am breathing only it, until my air is it. It's been only a week since my last visit to the counselor's office, and for perhaps the first time in many weeks, I'm not thinking about my next visit. I'm with my family. It's late evening. It's Christmas. Fire crackling in one corner, giant fur in another, overdecked halls stretched out between me and a view of the frozen lake that's polished and gleaming with a distant neighbor's twinkling Christmas lights. The dark hallway yawns at my feet. My mother emerges from the kitchen to stand beside me. I can feel the warmth of the oven radiating from her self-tanned skin, a faint whiff of gingerbread trailing her. She's wearing a cashmere sweater whose central feature is a large snowman's face. The snowman's plastic carrot nose grazes my shoulder as she turns to speak to me. "What about next week? Is next week okay?" she says. She can't help herself. The doctor's visit has been on her mind, and only hers, for the past few weeks. No one else wants to talk about it, especially my father. But someone has to keep everything together. I look down at her shoes. Shiny and black, with clear plastic heels trapping two identical miniature Santa Clauses, a small heap of snow gathered around their own miniature black boots. Each time she walks, the Santa Clauses walk with her through twin blizzards, trapped in their isolated cells. When my mother used to pick me up from elementary school, my classmates would place bets on the outlandishness of her outfits. Would there be a red ribbon this time? Would there be a matching polka-dotted bag? It made me feel proud, those bets. But it also made me feel shameful, as though some part of me was reflected in her physical garishness. "Dr. Julie's planning on checking your testosterone." "Oh," I say. There's nothing else to say. It'll be quick. We'll have some answers.
Good, I say. The twin clauses stare up at me, snow settling at their feet.
Make sure you tell your professors you'll be gone Tuesday.
Okay.
What's wrong, honey?
One of the clauses edges closer.
Nothing, I say.
It's just weird.
I know, she says. It'll be over soon.
The clauses turn their backs to me, lost again in their private blizzards. As my mother walks back to the kitchen, her pale cashmere becomes a flicker of white flame in the dim. I turn back to the hallway, to the glittering lake framed by the window. It is a dark gift waiting to be opened. It is precious, delicate, wrapped in all those twinkling lights. Perhaps this is just my low testosterone talking. Perhaps I will lose this precious image the minute Dr. Julie manages to spike my hormones. Perhaps I will lose all of my most treasured memories. Those moments of transcendent beauty when I finally visit Dr. Julie. Perhaps this is a small price to pay for a normal life. I stand in the hallway and try to will my testosterone levels to increase. If I can just make myself stop thinking. Left hand, palm down. Do not say to yourself, turn the left hand. I clench my hand into a fist and dig my nails into the soft lake of my palm until my breathing draws short. I want to punch the wall, rip my knuckles on the splintering wood, draw blood. But I can't. I can't make myself feel something that isn't there. I can only feel what I wish wasn't there. I wonder what I'll do when I can no longer fake it. I wonder if people will notice. Perhaps the testosterone really will solve all of these problems. Hijack my brain in a way meditation and prayer never could. Perhaps all of it really does come down to the body. I remember the taste of unleavened bread on my tongue. The words, "This is the body of Christ," echoing through the sanctuary. "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." I remember the shock of grape juice, the blood of Christ. The fear that this juice might actually turn to blood in my stomach, though the Baptists never believed such a thing was possible. I remember the one time I felt guilty about eyeing the Brewer twins in the front aisle as I sipped my juice and listened to all that unleavened bread being ground to grist by hundreds of molars. The Brewer back so straight and perfectly sculpted I couldn't help but look. And so I rushed to the bathroom after communion and forced myself to vomit up the body and blood of Christ, fearing I would be punished for my blasphemy if I kept him inside of me. The sight of Christ's floating remains similar to the curdled flesh I'd later see on the movie screen. This should have been a sign, I realize now. I can now see how the body controls the spirit. It was Christ's body that finally turned his ideas into reality. The proof of its absence, the very fact that finally convinced so many non-believers to convert to Christianity. It was David's body that first brought me to therapy. It was my lack of contact with Chloe's body that began all of this. If I can just learn to whittle my body down to a sharp blade, I might be able to harness this power of the body. This same power I will feel all over again while watching The Passion. This same one that my father knows how to wield so well in his sermons. All I need is a little help from Dr. Julie. I begin to hope. I feel the warmth from the kitchen on my skin, lending me strength, propelling me forward. I'm still standing in the hallway, watching the Christmas lights dance on the frozen lake outside. Someone is playing Nat King Cole. I remember Dominique telling me that she hates Nat King Cole. "That voice is so lifeless," she'd said, though I don't agree. I think of Charles and Dominique singing their way through the holidays in a neighborhood so unlike my own. Charles once told me of a stray bullet that bored a hole into the side of his house, nearly making its way through to where he was sitting on the couch. An inch more, and Charles might not have been alive to tell me that story. I think of his pain, of what he's been through and where he's come from, and where he is now, singing so beautifully in the college's cloistered theater. And before I can stop myself, I feel lucky to be alive in this moment, warm and happy, with this family who, despite the awkwardness with which they've treated me since they found out about my affliction, despite the fact that they've handled me as they would an unwanted piece of family china, are still a part of me. Still share the same warm blood that's pulsing through my veins as I walk barefooted down the hall. The swell of their voices behind me now. A nice, dull rhythm with indistinguishable words. not the words of anger or disgust or pity or love I imagine they've got poised in the backs of their throats. And so I step slowly, one foot in front of the other, out of the gold light toward the glittering lake. And I swear it's all too beautiful for one life, that I should be able to split into multiple versions of myself to savor the many flavors of this moment, knowing that these kinds of feelings might leave me once I visit the doctor's office, thinking, how can I ever repay this gift? How can I ever repay these people and the God these people worship and the God I still seem to worship? The dog, Daisy, brushes past my leg, panting. She looks up at me, her eyes watery. Her naked trust is too much. I look away, grateful for the feel of her beside me in the dark, with all that light behind both of us, as though the light is ready to buoy the two of us up directly into the window, hoist us out into the night sky above the lake. How can I say no to all of this? I think. So many people have brought me to this moment, and I've trusted them. Couldn't there be even greater moments ahead if only I trust them again? Tuesday comes, and I don't visit Dr. Julie. Something's come up, my mother says. Nothing else. I'm as confused as ever. I wonder if my parents have lost hope. If maybe all of this might fizzle out. My mother and I go a week without talking. The silence worries me. And it's only months later that I realize how strong the pact is that I made with myself that Christmas night with my family. It's only months later, after sitting for hours on a cold stone bench in a garden outside the humanities building, after walking in a daze down the path to the lake and staring into my dark silhouette in the placid water with all that moonlight at my back, my academic life packed squarely behind me, that I begin to realize just how far I will go. I will take this skinny frame and baptize it in the icy water, and I will walk back in my wet clothes, nearly frozen but more alive than ever, and with my exhausted body warming beneath the scalding shower stream, eyes trained on a drop of water tracing the showerhead, between my chattering teeth I will mutter the simplest of prayers to that great physician. Lord, make me pure. Exiting the shower, I will find my cell phone and text my mother, waking her from a dream. I'm ready, I'll write. Dr. Julie. Less than a week after watching The Passion with Charles and Dominique, my mother and I were sitting in Dr. Julie's examination room. That painting's in almost every doctor's office, my mother said. It's a pretty good painting. She couldn't seem to stop talking. Yeah? The painting was a print of a famous photorealistic Rockwell piece. The little boy pulling down his pants for the anonymous white-coated doctor, light streaming in from closed blinds behind him. The boy's gesture seemed so simple. Part of the rosy-colored past Rockwell was so talented at capturing. A moment of fear just before the relief. All the more sentimental because the pain was such a minor thing. Nothing to worry about, really. And the child would soon learn this after a few more visits to the doctor's office. The boy's fear was a fear most people got over early in their childhoods. And it was humorous, in the way adults often found childhood humorous, to see this boy's fear as trivial, as a phase he simply needed to grow out of. A prick of the needle, and it would all go away. I wonder how long Dr. Julie will be, my mother said. She'll be here soon, I said stupidly. She's always busy. There was nothing else to say. Dr. Julie did always seem to be a busy woman, flipping through charts and consulting medical records and prescribing medications on square white sheets and ripping them from their glued spine with a dignified flourish. But she always made it seem as though she didn't enjoy that part of her work nearly as much as she enjoyed the company of her patients. Let's get down to business, shall we? She said once she finally arrived, as if by entering the examination room she was fending off the technical part of her life, antiseptic, full of jargon, clicking the door shut on the tail of all that necessary nonsense so that she might finally crack her scrubbed knuckles, roll up her sleeves, and sit down on the creaking stool to hunch forward and stare into the eyes of the people who made her job worth it, becoming, in that instant, not a doctor per se, but also the little girl from just outside Salem, Arkansas, who used to wake up early mornings before school to feed the chickens. There were moments when the little girl and the doctor shared the same features, though they were rare occasions. She had attended my college, a fact that felt particularly salient on the morning I finally decided to connect my college life with my family one. What brings you two here today? As though she didn't know, that farm sunrise face of hers placid, loosed from the worries of the day. My mother sitting in all of her lace at the other end of the room, barely able to conceal the tremors that had seized her from the moment she'd first found out about my sexuality.
"I don't know where to begin," my mother said, clutching her purse to her chest.
Though there was no other starting point than the ugly truth of it, the secret stain that had fallen on our family. I knew she had already talked to Dr. Julie about my sexuality, that the two of them were close, that Dr. Julie wanted to protect my mother from the stark reality of having a gay son in the South in a strictly religious community. I knew all of this just by the way they spoke to each other, sympathy running like a current through the room. My eyes now focused on the mottled tile beneath my dangling feet. I had the feeling that merely looking up at them would instantly sweep me into that current, so I kept my head down.
"Why don't we start with the obvious?" Dr. Julie said. "You're worried about your son."
Shifting, the rustle of lace on lace. Despite everything, my mother had walked to my bedroom that morning to ask if I thought she looked cute, standing in my doorway like some kind of ice-draped queen, her purposely yellowed point de gaze stacked in stitched layers across her chest and repeated as a skirt below a high-waisted black belt. No, I thought, more like the snowdrop flower, the galanthus, and all of its wilted beauty. Even in her gloom and fear, my mother knew how to be fashionable. It was the thing that took her out of the situation, this love of texture, of fine cloth and fine detail. She had wrapped herself in as much of its exaggerated beauty as she could, calling up the spirits of post-antebellum anguish to defend her against what she now had to face in the light of a doctor's office. She was no Dolly Parton, as many Northerners erroneously assumed, with the heavily produced, heavily mascaraed optimism of a South no one would recognize in daily living. Instead, she was fierce and determined, like many Southerners, if only you looked beneath the smile and the lace. A woman whose situation had changed for the worse in the past decade. First after losing her parents, then after becoming a preacher's wife, and now after finding this stain on the family that must have been there all along, right under the small nose she'd inherited from her mother's side. Nevertheless, she'd been taught to persevere, to wait it out within all of the glory she could muster. And what could she say now, sitting across from Dr. Julie, when she hadn't even admitted to herself that the words gay or homosexual might actually have currency in her life?
"I don't think he's eating enough," she finally said. "He's lost at least 10 pounds in the past month."
I shifted my leg so the blood could get to it, my toes already numb. Paper rustled under my thighs. No matter how I sat, I always managed to tear the paper. It was embarrassing, that quiet ripping sound in the middle of a quiet examination room, every motion amplified. And just beneath the paper, the squeaking plastic, as though part of the examination was designed to measure your ability to sit perfectly still, to remain calm in the face of whatever diagnosis you might receive. I couldn't help but feel that each of my mannerisms was being recorded, graphed into a chart that could be used to determine the extent of my homosexuality.
"You do look a little skinnier," Dr. Julie said, squeaking on her stool to face me.
"I'm eating the same," I lied. "Just running more." The campus trees slipping past me in the dark, yellow lamppost after yellow lamppost guiding me into their narrow circles of light, the lake glistening moon white and wind whipped in the distance. That part was true. I hadn't stopped running since my parents told me we needed to consider therapy. The lie about the food, however, was pointless, though we all knew I needed to say something to account for my sudden weight loss, for the way my clothes no longer clung to me, my cotton sweater now meeting my skin only where it fell against my collarbone, my shoulders, the lengths of my skinny arms. I wasn't eating, and it was apparent to everyone in the room, as easily measured by the naked eye as a good tap on the knee measures the reflexes, though Dr. Julie tended to shy away from such formal introductions, skipping ahead to the heart of the ailment.
"I'm worried," my mother said. "Nothing fits him anymore."
Often, it felt like a small victory to realize that another point of contact had lost its hold on me. I was in control of how quickly I lost the weight, and it felt good not only to feel the past leaving my body, all that fat like rings of a trunk now narrowing, disappearing, but also to see the shock on people's faces, the lack of recognition at first glance, the double take. I was a different boy.
"I think he's trying to torture himself," my mother said, turning to face me, her high heels tapping against the tile.
I remembered the cat-o'-nine-tails falling across Christ's blood-ribboned back. No, this wasn't torture. This was control. Once Dr. Julie helped me increase my testosterone levels, I would gain even more control.
Honey, I think you're trying to torture yourself. I have some ideas about what's going on, Garrett,
Dr. Julie was saying, pronouncing my name as though it were a delicate thing caught in the grip of her slight cowgirl drawl. And it was truly delicate. Part of a family history that took pride in the men who inherited the name, passed down from great-great-grandfather to great-grandfather to grandfather, and finally to me. My mother and Dr. Julie and I were aware that, should I fail the test of manhood, I might never add another namesake to our family line. Instead, my name might come to be associated with the moment our family fell apart. A big empty space beneath my entry on the family tree.
Did you hear us? Dr. Julie said. We think it's best if I speak to you one-on-one.
My mother was rustling out of the room. The door was closing. The lights were blurring on the tile, re-emerging as bright orbs.
Now,
Dr. Julie said, the room suddenly too quiet for her loud voice. This whole thing must have been new for her as well. Talking openly about the subject of sexuality wasn't an option in most Arkansan towns like this one. Even, I suspected, no, especially in a medical setting. The idea of a sin having a biological basis would have shocked most people in my congregation, but this was just what many churches were beginning to suspect as they began stocking their foyers with brochures from Love in Action. Most people simply didn't read the brochures, passing by the plastic sleeves without so much as a single glance. I looked up from the tile to see Dr. Julie just inches from me, her face carrying a look of genuine concern.
Listen, Dr. Julie began. I know what it's like to torture yourself. I've done it myself.
That's not what I'm doing, I lied.
Yes, you are, she continued, crossing her arms over her chest. And that's fine, as long as it's just a phase. I've always had a weight problem, and until I had gastric bypass surgery, I used to binge. If I thought this was purely a weight thing, I'd be all right with checking your weight every now and then, doing some checkups. But this isn't just a weight thing, is it?
I didn't feel like answering her rhetorical question, so I kept quiet.
No, this is a sexuality thing. And what your mom is worried about is how this is going to affect your future. You're already wasting away. Imagine what you'll be like when more people find out. Now, my question for you is, do you want to change? Because I know plenty of people who've accepted this part of themselves, and they've managed to make a good life of it. It's difficult, but they've managed. There are plenty of rumors, people who talk about them the minute their backs are turned, job opportunities lost because of personal vendettas, but they've managed. Is that what you want?
I want to change, I said. I'm tired of feeling this way.
It gets easier, she said. You can move somewhere else, to a bigger city.
I don't want to run away. I love my family. It felt ridiculous to say these words. They were so simple, so childish. But I couldn't help myself. They were true.
Listen,
Dr. Julie continued, turning toward the door, her stool squeaking.
I'm going to have someone draw blood to test for testosterone levels, white blood cell count, things like that. I don't expect to find anything irregular. I don't expect this to do anything but satisfy your mother. She just wants to know she's done everything she can.
She let this sink in for a few seconds. It was the equivalent of, let's say we did and not, that we would actually go through with the blood test out of formality, and weeks later find everything to be perfectly normal. There would be no clear diagnosis.
If you ever need to talk to someone, you know I'm here, right?
I know, I said.
You wait here while I go get the nurse, she said, leaving the room.
I fished out my vibrating phone from my jeans, the paper tearing under my thighs. It was Charles. We hadn't talked in more than a week. I'd been in and out of the room to get my things, but mostly kept to the library every night until midnight. When are you coming back? Are you all right? His text read. You disappeared. I sent him a quick response so he wouldn't worry before I could think too much about my answer. I'm a ghost, I wrote. Never better. Later that morning, when I walked outside with my mother, a patch of cotton taped to the crook of my elbow, I agreed to stay home for a few days just for her sake, knowing that these next few weeks would be harder for her than they would be for me.
"Let's go to the movies," she said. "My treat."
And after we finished watching some romantic comedy, the snow still hadn't fallen. I would wish for snow for the rest of the season, all of 2 weeks. I would imagine the two of us falling back into a pile of snow and sculpting wings as wide as our arms could go without breaking. Monday, June 14th, 2004. The Hampton Inn suite where my mother and I stayed during my time at LIA was large, but it felt too small. Though we shared separate rooms, the only privacy we had was a small plywood door that separated the living room area from the bedroom where my mother slept. After my first week of therapy, details about the room we never would have noticed under other circumstances began to take on menacing qualities. At night, a single lamp glinted at us from the corner of the room, its defunct twin dark in the opposite corner. The overhead light connected to a fan, and couldn't be switched on without the blades whipping the air above our heads into rapid, unpleasant currents. Our sturdy metal door's sliding chain lock seemed suddenly inadequate in the dim light. It was easy to imagine a pair of pliers gripping the taut chain in its teeth. At any other time in our lives, this would have been a perfectly fine, safe room. And yet each night I pushed the coffee table flush against the door, hoping I might at least hear scratching on the small patch of linoleum before an intruder could manage to fully enter the room. Standing in front of the bathroom mirror, I would imagine hidden cameras aimed at my naked body. Taking a shower, I would think of Hitchcock and his gleaming psycho knife. I would think of Janet Leigh hightailing it out of town with a stash of stolen cash in her passenger seat, pulling into the one nondescript motel where she might find temporary asylum. It was telling that my mother and I never asked anyone to fix these minor problems. Though I didn't realize it at the time, these problems comforted me. The space they occupied in my mind a bulwark against the more threatening intruders who crouched and waited somewhere beyond my limited perspective. Every inch of the room palpable in the dark, learned by heart. The room. One article out of place, one minor change, would have had the power to alert me to the more drastic changes occurring just outside of it. If the improvements started here, in this room, then they would have the power to continue ad infinitum outside of it. What then would stop me from immediately acting on my current plan? Sunday night, I snuck out of the hotel again sometime after midnight to run through the suburban streets. I ran so long and hard that I began to lose track of time, and in that timelessness I watched the moon slide down the night sky. I imagined how small I must have looked from above. God was a bully, I decided, messing with such small people. Why had he done this to us? To our family? Fuck God, I said to the moon, once again half expecting to be struck by inexplicable lightning. When nothing happened, I repeated the curse, louder each time, the words echoing through the empty neighborhoods. Fuck God, fuck God, fuck God! I returned to the hotel room and doubled over near my cot, nearly vomiting from exhaustion and fear. Who was I? Who was this man who cursed God? Better yet, who was God? Had he abandoned me, or had he never existed in the first place? As I sat there, trying to slow my breathing, I decided I would fake my way through this second week, grit my teeth and pretend that everything was fine. Therapy was turning me into someone I didn't recognize, and I needed to leave this place with my heart still relatively intact. LIA's logo, the heart-shaped cutout, glared up at me from my handbook each day, threatening excision, and I worried that what lay on the other side, post-op, was he and his many cardigans. One thing was certain. I didn't want to act too quickly, alert the LIA staff to my intentions. I knew they would immediately inform my parents, and my parents would then be forced to suggest that I stay longer, do the 3-month residency, then the 1 year, then the 2 years, until I wound up in the position of my counselors, trapped in a cycle of progression and regression, never knowing who I really was. In his own way, the blonde-haired boy had already warned me of this. Thumbing through my phone's contact list the next morning, he'd glanced up briefly and said, "I hope you're serious about your time here. People are thinking you might not be serious." I couldn't tell if he'd noticed Mark Bathroom's number, if he might use this information later as evidence against me, but it didn't seem to matter. The message was clear. The important thing was to keep things looking exactly as they had the week before. And as Smith had walked us through our pre-lunch authority and trust session, as he began to speak of the evils and delusions of self-sufficiency, the sun haloing his graying blonde hair, I'd nodded my head along with the others, smiled, plastered on a face of concern, the face of someone contemplating the words of a great leader. When asked, I turned to page 33 of my addiction workbook and read the words as Smith read aloud. We strongly conclude that self-sufficiency will provide us with the security and comfort we're aching for. We start looking for a way to avoid or numb our pain. I pretended that self-sufficiency would only lead to a dead end, that I had given up my life to the authority of the counselors, and by extension, to a God who had refused to answer my prayers since I'd come to the facility. I pretended that I didn't trust myself, all the while thinking, fuck God, repeating the curse in my head during those moments when Smid's words felt as though they might drag me back into the self-loathing I'd narrowly escaped at the ordination ceremony. I acted the devotee, but with a pinch of struggle. For inspiration, I consulted my childhood memories, but I never mistook the self-loathing I unearthed there for the real thing. I couldn't forget the love that I'd felt emanating from some deep place inside my chest as I stood on the sanctuary stage with my family. We learn to manipulate, Smith added. We learn to be seductive, purposely unclear about our motivations in relationships as self-protection. I looked up from the workbook. The words didn't seem so naked, so vapid when he said them. It was easier to lie when you believe the lie.
It's stuffy in there, my mother said that evening, closing the plywood door behind her. She entered the part of the suite where I slept each night on the fold-out couch. Before the gap closed, I caught sight of her rumpled bed. It was rare for my mother to leave a bed unmade, and from where I was sitting, I could see that she had made no attempt to even tuck the ballooning edges of the white sheets into the corners. I was sitting in the corner of the hotel room, trying to come up with another sinful transgression for my moral inventory. It was getting late, but I wanted to finish my homework before we ordered dinner, and though it was still painful to look directly at each of my sins, I was beginning to find enjoyment in the simple act of writing, in putting everything down in longhand. My cursive looped in arabesques, nearly diving off the edges of the pages. I practiced making each line perfect. Looking down at my yellow tablet notebook, I could squint until the words blurred into a single lead-colored tapestry. LIA's standard phrases. We are affected by a sinful world system, our sinful flesh, and the manipulative attacks of Satan, became an exercise in wrapping each of my sloping F's beneath the letters preceding it in the word. My mother sat on the couch and folded her hands in her lap, nodding her head to some inaudible and internal monologue. The coal-like eyeliner circling her eyes had diminished to a thin band, and her hair was no longer in vibrant curls. The strands were slack, hanging limp on her shoulders. She'd stopped visiting the tanning salon during the long afternoons before she picked me up from the facility, but her skin was still darker than usual, as though she'd fallen asleep in a field somewhere and wandered back to civilization without ever bothering to check her reflection. She looked at least 10 years older than when we'd first arrived in Memphis. "Your dad asked how we're doing," she said. I could see now that she clutched a pink cell phone in one hand, that she must have been talking to my father in the other room. "I told him we're okay."
"Yeah."
"We have a few more days," she said, checking the cell phone for the time, the white screen lighting up in her palm. Though she hadn't said it, I knew how to complete the sentence. "For you to be cured."
I tapped the mechanical pencil against the yellow tablet. I was halfway through the assignment, but nothing new was coming. I tried searching my memory for a longer sexual fantasy, one to fill up a whole page, but I'd already exhausted most of them, and what was left seemed almost too minor to note. The many times in high school when my eyes had followed the sloping curve of a boy's leg until the shadowy interior of his gym shorts swallowed up the mystery. The underwear ads I would walk by in the clothing section of Walmart, pretending to be only casually interested in the cut and fit of the boxer briefs, squeezing the material behind the posing model's abs as though I were testing the strength of the material. It was a problem I was glad to face, being relatively free of sin. But it was still a problem. I had confessed this to Jay just that morning, looking to his extra months at LIA for guidance, and Jay had admitted that he now made up most of his stories. "I ran out the first week I was here," he'd said. We were alone on the patio, with no one around to hear us, so I thought I'd try to imagine new ones. The rest of the patients were huddled near the kitchen, secure in the air conditioning. I could already feel the sweat beating at the top of my forehead, the sun burning my hair. Really? It was almost always one-syllable answers with Jay. I felt stupid standing next to his intelligence, his pain. There were things I wanted him to know about myself that I couldn't say. How, under different circumstances, I could be really smart. How I read good literature. How I was going to be a writer one day. But I never knew how to work them into the conversation without sounding awkward and egotistical. "If I repent for sins I haven't even committed," Jay said, tucking a long strand of hair behind his ear, "I figure God might even bump me up to step 5. According to Jay, step 5 took an infinitely long time, and step 5 was still 7 rungs below the finish. In the distance between his current step, step 4, making a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, and step 5, admitting to our Heavenly Father, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, stood the vastness of the abyss, stood hellfire. It was one thing to admit the approximate nature of our wrongs, but the exact nature? We could barely understand our own sinful urges. Even had I been fully committed to discovering a cure at this point, from where I was standing at step 1, explaining these urges to another person in great detail seemed nearly impossible. Even Smith never claimed to have made it through all the steps without stumbling every now and then. "Most of us learn to forgive ourselves for backsliding," Jay said, brushing my shoulder as he turned to look back at our group. His touch a sudden jolt that left a metallic aftertaste under my tongue. "It's all part of the process. We acknowledge it, forget it, and move on to the next step." I could already imagine the disgusted looks in the staff members' eyes as I said, "I experienced a fantasy," and as one of them said, "Without describing too many sinful details, could you explain the situation?" It would be even worse during my one-on-one therapy session with Cosby. I would be asked to describe the contours of my fantasy, the ways in which this fantasy had held me in Satan's vice grip, how it now disgusted me, Cosby's face twisting into a look of revulsion that I would need to mimic if I wanted to convince him of my progress. I reread the sample MI in the handbook beside me, searching for inspiration. "I do not need sex or anything else to medicate with, even though I still desire to do so at times. I have a lot to say, and I choose to share it appropriately. I have worth. I am intelligent, funny, caring, and strong. I am masculine." My mother and I kept silent for several minutes, my pencil poised over the edge. Masculine. The word looked so greedy, sitting there at the end of the line, summing up everything that had come before it. But wasn't that the end goal? Masculine meant strong. Masculine meant straight. If we could only learn the essence of what it meant to be masculine, then we could learn the rest. I ripped out the page of cursive, wadded it into a ball, and threw it in the trash can. Too feminine. The best I could do at this point was copy everything down, write it in sloppy print, make myself appear as masculine as possible on paper and in person. I began a new sheet. My sentences grew shorter, my verbs blunter. Before the counselors took away my notebook, I had been producing poor imitations of Faulkner. Now I tried imitating Chekhov, Hemingway, Carver. I wrote about my fantasies with a coldness I hadn't even known was possible. When I first met him, I had impure thoughts. He was attractive to me. He was a vision of masculinity that I craved because I had been denied it at a young age. I was angry with myself for liking him. I knew I was wrong. I knew I needed to ask God for help. I didn't even know who this fantasy person was. It could have been any boy I'd ever had a crush on. It could have been Jay. I added a few more stock details to make sure no one in our group thought it was Jay. He was much older. He drove a pickup truck. He smoked Marlboro cigarettes. I'd been extra careful that morning, distancing myself from Jay to make sure no one noticed my growing attraction to him. Standing on the patio during break, just the two of us with the sun hot on our arms, I'd made sure to keep a generous patch of concrete between us. And when Jay said, "We aren't really supposed to be alone back here," I agreed with him.
walked up to the door without hesitation, and slid it back and put a pane of glass between us. Rule number 2, when in doubt, don't. I looked up, the afterimage of the handbook's words floating like red banner across the dark room, my mother's face half hidden in shadow. After a few seconds, I finally broke the silence. I wanted to let her in on the therapy lingo, test it out on her, and see what her reaction might be. "Was Dad ever an alcoholic?" I said. We watched each other's reflections through the shadow world of the empty television set, where the distance between us was even greater.
"Why would you ask me that?" she said.
"It's for a project," I said. "Genograms. The sins of the fathers. I want to make sure I got everything right." The moment slid once again into silence. I thought we might drift into that dark shadow world. Never speak again.
"What about the sins of the mothers?" she finally asked.
We must have sat like that, staring at each other in the empty television for a long time. "That too, I guess.
Your dad had some experiences with alcohol, but your grandfather was the real alcoholic. Anyway, it was a long time ago."
I thought of my grandfather, my father's father, the drunk. On the rare occasions when I'd visited him, he'd barely recognized me. And even in moments when he had recognized me, he'd called me by my middle name, Clayton, Clay, as if the name I'd inherited from my maternal grandfather was part of an identity he didn't want to recognize. He was a small man with small arms and a small, desiccated face, the face of someone who'd already traded all of his good smiles for that last drop of alcohol. It was hard to imagine how he'd ever had enough power to whip anyone, how he'd ever managed to inspire fear with these small muscles of his. Standing beside my father, my grandfather had seemed a tiny man, the opposite of masculine. And yet somehow, my father had managed to take those raw materials and form his own version of the ideal Southern man. What was I missing then? Where was the defect? The more I thought about these things, the more LIA's logic began to break down, and I wanted my mother to be there when it happened.
"I can't understand why you'd need to ask me this," my mother said.
She was standing up now. The lamplight met her at a sharp angle. The freckles on her face and arms a painter's absent-minded, expert flicking of wetted brush.
"Well," I said, drawing out my words, "they need to know where all of my sexual feelings come from."
"I don't understand any of this," she said. "Why do they need to know so much about our family? What does our family have to do with sexual feelings?"
"They say a lot of it's caused by childhood trauma."
"What step is this in?"
"I'm still on step 1.
"How long does each step take?"
"I have no idea. Months? Years?"
"Years?"
"Some of the new counselors have been there for more than 2 years. The older ones have been there for a decade."
My mother was straightening her wrinkled blouse. She looked to the mirror hanging on the opposite wall, teased up her hair. After a few seconds, she grabbed the car keys from the coffee table. I wondered if we were going to leave right then. I wondered if she might march into the office and demand an explanation. Before the silence fell on us again, she said,
"Let's go out tonight. Forget the rules. Get some real food."
LIA was very clear about its safe zone rules. There was a map on one of the facility's walls that listed the few areas in the city without any malls, restaurants, movie theaters, secular bookstores, or porn shops. Every part of the city was forbidden except for places with the word Christ in it, really. Our hotel was situated directly in the center of LIA's map, as far from sinful influences as possible. The idea of leaving, if only for a moment, was tempting. Something other than stale KFC biscuits, cold gravy, a pile of picked bones tucked away in a paper box. Something other than half-empty parking lots and homogeneous strip malls. I closed the handbook, the plastic sleeve cracking along the spine. I pictured the crack of my grandfather's belt, my father in a corner with one forearm raised to protect his face.
"Did he ever fight back?" I said.
"Dad, did he ever try to leave home?" My mother walked past me to the door. She slid the chain through its gutter and unbolted the deadlock, a hollow slicing sound.
"There are some questions I don't ask."
Outside, the air was even hotter and more humid than I remembered, but a slight breeze followed us to the car, daring us forward. After I had sat in the facility's antiseptic light for hours,
The promise of an elegant dinner in a good restaurant was like the promise of manna in the desert. I half expected LIA staff members to flag us down as we exited the hotel parking lot, their arms waving.